Hello and welcome to the Science Podcast for July 11th, 2008. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, recessive genes are linked to autism, how scientists perceive their interactions with the mass media, and increasing rates of bipolar disorder diagnoses in children. All this and more, plus our usual roundup of stories from our free online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the Science Society, publishers of Science Magazine, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. The American Association for the Advancement of Science at www.aaas.org.
For the first time, scientists have identified recessive genes associated with autism spectrum disorders, brain disorders that impair social interaction and behavior. The recessivity of these genes clarifies how autism persists because people with the disorder do not tend to have children. In a paper in this week's Science, Christopher Walsh and colleagues report that even though there are dozens of gene mutations that might be associated with autism spectrum disorders, many of those mutations seem to be tied to a common mechanism of cellular learning. Walsh says that common thread offers the hope for the development of future autism therapies. I spoke with Walsh from his office at Children's Hospital in Boston.
We were interested in trying to understand more about the causes of autism spectrum disorders. And it's been thought for a long time to have a large genetic cause. However, we know relatively little about what the genes are that might cause the condition. In fact, we can only arrive at a specific genetic diagnosis for children with autism in about 15% of the cases. So we wanted to try to increase our understanding of the genetic causes because we always know that by understanding more about genetic causes of disease, we can understand more about the cellular mechanism of the disease. And that's the best way to try to develop better treatments.
Now, because this is genetic, I suppose there's some component of heritability. What's already known about the heritability of autism spectrum disorders?
So we know that autism spectrum disorders are among the most heritable, if not the most heritable, of all neuropsychiatric conditions. However, the paradox has been that many of the genetic causes that have been identified for autism have two prominent features. First of all, each cause only accounts for 1% or less of all children. So there are about 20 or so known causes, but each account for a small proportion of the disease. And second of all, in fact, a lot of the mutations that are associated with autism are not necessarily inherited by the families. And that's kind of a paradox because we think of genetic things as inherited by definition. But in fact, autism is a severe disorder of children, and these serious disorders of children are often characterized by mutations that are spontaneous, because of the fact that children with autism don't usually have families of their own. And so these mutations that cause autism are not usually transmitted in families, but instead arise spontaneously.
And so to examine the heritability of autism spectrum disorders, how then would looking at the family history of people help?
So what we wanted to do in this study was to take a different approach to studying the heritability of autism that had not been tried before for autism, but which had been used in our lab and other labs very successfully for studying other developmental brain disorders of children, other disorders such as mental retardation or genetic forms of cerebral palsy. And the approach that we took for studying autism was to look for particular kinds of inherited causes, which are referred to as recessive causes. And recessive diseases are diseases where people can be silent carriers. And no one had really taken a systematic look for recessive causes of autism before, but we know that recessive causes are very common for other forms of mental retardation and epilepsy and other developmental disorders of children. So the approach we took to studying recessive causes of autism was to look for families where the parents shared a common ancestor. In other words, where the parents were cousins, for example.
So recent ancestors.
Recent ancestors, yes. Typically cousins, first cousins or second cousins. And the reason why we looked for this is because recessive causes of disease are somewhat more common in such families, in the offspring of parents that are cousins. But also, and more importantly, that the recessive causes are very easy to trace through such families. And we applied that technique of tracing shared ancestry to autism for the first time. And we found that it actually works very well. First of all, we learned that there are some recessive causes, and we had not known any before that, before today. The second thing we learned is consistent with findings from other recent studies of autism, namely that it appears appears that there are many different genes that can cause autism or autism spectrum disorders. That the disorder that we refer to as the autism spectrum disorder is actually a host of different conditions that can look very similar to one another, but that will ultimately, in most kids, have distinct genetic causation. That we estimate that there are at least dozens of different genes, perhaps more than 100, that can be disabled in children with autism. The third thing that we learned is that despite this diversity of genetic causes of autism, which can be a little bit discouraging and frustrating to clinicians, that in fact there was a hopeful sign that many of these diverse causes of autism may focus on a common cellular mechanism. And that common cellular mechanism has to do with the way neurons change in response to activity. Because we learn by having neurons change their connections to one another. And that is the basis of learning and memory. We found that several of the genes that we identified as associated with autism seem to focus on this common process of cellular and molecular learning, so that this apparent diversity of causes of autism may actually have a common focus in the cell. And that's really what we're after, is to understand the cellular mechanism of the disease, because that's the best way to design treatments. And so we're actually very hopeful that by understanding that there might be a common mechanism of cellular learning, that that might give us a way to develop treatments down the line.
Is there something characteristic of the genetics associated with autism?
I think one of the aspects of this work that I found particularly encouraging was that some of the mutations that we identified in children with autism don't seem to necessarily completely remove a gene. And I find that hopeful because it's difficult to develop gene replacement as a mode of treatment in humans, and we'd like to find other ways of ameliorating the disease. Many of the mutations that we found don't seem to completely remove a gene, but instead seem to affect the on-off switches that control when and where the genes are expressed. And it implies that, in fact, some of these genes are present in the brain but are not activated properly. They're not turned on the way they ought to be. And I find that to be a very hopeful message therapeutically, because there are ways that are being discovered to activate genes which are present in the genome but which are silent. So, in fact, this might be an unanticipated way of developing therapies in the long term for autism. Identify these kids where all the right genes are present but just not turned on in the right way, and then find other ways to get in there and turn the right genes on in the right time and in the right place.
Will this research also be along the path towards a genetic test that could tell people who wish to have children that their children may have an increased risk of autism?
For the families that were involved in the study where we were able to identify genetic causes, then we can immediately offer them a genetic test that can help predict the risk of having affected offspring. The challenge with genetic testing of autism is always this diversity of the causes, because there are many different genes that have to be tested in any given child. And so our work, as well as other work from other labs, is moving us towards that day when we'll be able to get a more systematic genetic test for kids with autism.
So this is not a test then for parents that you're envisioning. This would be a test for children already born.
It would be a test for children to elucidate what the genes are that are abnormal in those particular children, and then would be a potential test as well for parents to determine whether they carry the same sort of disabling changes in their genome and whether they might be therefore at risk for passing on those changes to other children.
Christopher Walsh, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Christopher Walsh is senior author of a paper on identifying autism loci and genes by tracing recent shared ancestry. Read the paper in this week's Science. Also this week in Science, threatened reefs. In a paper published online, Kent Carpenter and colleagues report that climate change and local human-caused disturbances have elevated the extinction risk for a third of reef-building corals. The team compiled data for 704 coral species and classified their conservation status across 8 categories, from least concern to extinct, according to criteria from the International Union of Conservation of Nature Red List. 10 years ago, only 13 of those 704 species would have been categorized in the 3 threatened categories of critically endangered, endangered, or vulnerable. Now, that number has risen to 231, in part due to massive bleaching events in 1998. Read more about it at scienceexpress.org. When you think about how science is generally covered in the mass media, you might think that it goes pretty poorly. But when scientists were surveyed about their own interactions with the mass media, they tended to think of them as fairly positive. In a policy forum in this week's Science, Hans-Peter Peters and colleagues report the analysis of their survey, which suggests that media contacts of scientists in top research and development countries are more frequent and smoother than previously thought. I spoke with Peters from his office at the research center in Jülich, Germany.
The problem we were dealing with in our paper is that on one hand, there is a perhaps increasing demand for science to be in the media. But on the other hand, there are well-known problems of communication between scientists and journalists. There is a widespread impression of a difficult relationship. So we wanted to know about the current state of the science media interface in major countries. So we did a survey of biomedical researchers in Germany, France, Japan, United Kingdom, and the United States. And when analyzing their responses, we found that contacts of scientists with the media are much more frequent and more smooth than we had previously thought. And furthermore, we found that there is rather a strong similarity between the different countries in that respect.
What is meant by a smooth interaction? Is it journalists aren't asking the tough questions or what?
Well, smooth means that scientists seem to accept the rules of the media when they answer questions of journalists. And the evaluation of the scientists after the talk to the journalists are surprisingly positive. So they will not only say, in general, the relations with the journalists are quite good, their experiences are rated quite good, but they will also say, well, this for specific aspects, like it was a pleasant experience or our research was well explained and so on and so forth. So we were very surprised about the consistency in the positive responses to different kinds of questions.
Why were you surprised?
Well, we were surprised because the talks about the science-media relationship is different. So if you go to a conference and talk to scientists and science managers, you will often hear complaints about journalists, about how the media covers science. Actually, this is partly reflected also in our data, because if asked about the science coverage in general, scientists tend to be more critical than if they are asked about their own encounters with the media. So this is why one would expect a different kind of answer pattern than we found in our survey.
So you wanted to survey to figure out whether or not this anecdotal evidence was accurate or not.
Actually, that was one of our main goals, to find out and to give the scientists and science managers a clear database assessing the status of the science media relationship. Although saying it's a smooth relationship doesn't mean necessarily that it is a good one. Because you could argue if it's very smooth, then perhaps the journalists aren't doing their job of being critical towards science and looking behind the scenes and so on and so forth. So it's not possible to equate smooth with good.
Did your team also survey journalists as well, say comparing how they rate their interviewee interactions with scientists versus those of other professions?
We did do that in other studies, but not in this study. The reason why we didn't it is simply lack of funding. It would have been a very good idea to also survey the other side of that relationship, and maybe a good idea to do that in one of the next studies.
What does your team perceive to be the reasons behind why science journalist interactions are not smooth?
Okay, there are several reasons you would expect, and they have been confirmed in prior research, that make the interactions of scientists and journalists difficult. One thing is that the cultures are different. And that means, for example, that scientists are looking for providing accurate information to the media, while journalists are looking for the sensational message and so on and so forth. And many studies show that this expectation is not met. So there is a high error rate from the point of view of scientists in the media. The media, on the other hand, will be interested in clear statements that refer to everyday life or to politics, that are bold in a way and that are not so technical. And that is one of the tensions that arise. Another thing is that prior research has shown scientific norms to be a barrier to public communication for scientists, in that they ask scientists or require scientists to limit their contacts outside.
Did your survey address the reasons why scientists are willing to talk to the media?
Oh, yes, that was one of our key questions. We looked at motives that would lead scientists to think positive about media contacts and motives that would make them reluctant to deal with the media. The most important motive for scientists seems to be to secure public legitimacy. That means to secure public support for their research.
Public support eventually translating into financial support.
Yes, it is financial support, but it may also be favorable regulations for research. If you think of human embryonic stem cell research, it's not only funding, it's also government or political regulation of that research in some countries.
Now, you mentioned there were differences among countries in their responses. What were some of those differences?
The main message is the differences are rather minor. But if we look closely, we find some differences. For example, we find somewhat higher satisfaction with the media in, I think, a German scientist than, for example, in British scientists. The British scientists were somewhat more critical in several questions. But one interesting difference is concerning the motives scientists have when talking to the media. The Western countries, it's always finding or securing public acceptance of research. And this motive is much less important for the Japanese researchers. For them, building public reputation, public image is more important than for the other countries. So on the level of motivators and also in some other questions related to attitudes, the differences between countries are larger than in the actual communication practices. And we think that is because nowadays, it is not something which is at the discretion of a researcher to engage in communication with the media or not, but it is an expected behavior.
So is that the culture of the scientific institutions themselves in those countries, or is it something about the countries themselves that make for these different attitudes?
I think it is, in the end, it is a consequence of the increasing and more important role of the media in our societies. So because the media are so central for policy making, for public legitimacy, and so on and so forth, all institutions and all actors who depend on public acceptance have to go to the media, have to be present in the media. And I think that is a major factor that leads to this kind of pattern of interactions that we find. And so this is the reason why the pattern in the different countries is quite similar on the interaction level, but different on the motivation level. For me, this is a very important finding because it relates our findings to more general discussion about the structure of our societies that we might call democratic knowledge societies.
Hans-Peter Peters, thank you very much.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Hans-Peter Peters is lead author of a policy forum on scientists' interactions with mass media. Read more about it in this week's Science.
This is Nancy Goff, editor of Science Signaling. We are now accepting original research submissions for publication starting September 2008. The journal formerly known as Science's SDKE is devoted to the topic of cellular signal transduction. To learn more, go to www.sciencesignaling.org.
Bipolar disorder is a serious mental condition affecting about 3% of the adult population here in the United States. According to the National Institute of Mental Health, the disease typically develops in early adulthood, but some people have their first symptoms during childhood. Over the past 15 years, the number of children diagnosed with bipolar disorder has been rising sharply. Science news writer Constance Holden writes about it in this week's issue.
This article is about the steep increase in diagnoses of bipolar disorder in children. This is a mental illness that is really awful. It's not just a matter of being in a bad mood sometimes and being in a good mood sometimes. People plummet into the most terrible depressions. Bipolar disorder is one of the biggest causes of suicide. They also get into manic states where they, in adults, it's shown by furious spending, grandiose plans, and it's what used to be known as manic depression. And diagnoses have rocketed in the past 15 years or so, and nobody is sure exactly why.
Is this really an increase in the number of incidences, or are the kids just being relabeled?
That's what's not entirely clear, but most of the psychiatrists I talk to think that this more closely reflects the true incidence. And one piece of evidence for that is the fact that surveys of adult people with bipolar illness, 60% of them say that their symptoms started in childhood.
What are some of the other reasons why scientists are saying that there's been this increase?
I think that most scientists agree that there has not been an increase in severely disturbed kids, but that parents are recognizing it more readily and more readily taking kids into doctors. And doctors are more willing to see this as an illness and not just something a kid will grow out of. But most people do not think there's an actual increase. Some people think the pharmaceutical industry is the driving force behind this because it's always coming up with new drugs and selling them hard to doctors. But the psychiatrists I talk to think that there is very little problem of over-medication and much more a problem of under-medication and of kids who need help not getting it.
What medicines are used to treat bipolar disorder?
Well, the primary thing is mood stabilizers, and the number one mood stabilizer is lithium, which was discovered in the 1950s. But only about half of people respond to lithium, so there are other drugs. Anti-seizure drugs are the main ones. But these kids usually have a welter of problems. They very often have attention deficit hyperactivity disorder at the same time. So once the mood is stabilized, they may also be getting Ritalin, and they may also be getting anxiety drugs, anti-anxiety drugs. They also may be getting regular antidepressants. But the first thing is that they have to have their mood stabilized, because otherwise antidepressants alone can trigger mania in someone who's susceptible, and so can Ritalin.
I can imagine that there would be downsides to not having this diagnosed properly, but are there any downsides to the treatment for bipolar disorder, especially for children while they're still developing?
I think that's a question that probably really has not been answered. The doctors always want to start out with as small a dose as possible and see if it's effective and then gradually raise the dose. Nobody starts out with a huge dose. With lithium, there is a side effect of you can get a tremor from high doses of lithium, but that goes away if you stop taking it. It's not a permanent thing.
Why is bipolar disorder so hard to diagnose in the first place?
Well, because children don't follow the classic pattern that's in the psychiatry's Bible, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. They have a mixture of symptoms, and they're much less likely than adults to be cyclical, you know, to have periods of mania and then periods of depression. Rather, they will be irritable, explosive, acting manic, but at the same time, they can also show symptoms of depression and do badly at school and other symptoms of depression.
And looking at children and adults, then, are researchers getting any closer to understanding the roots of bipolar disorder?
Well, searches for genes have been pretty fruitless. There have been candidate locations that have been identified, but it's becoming pretty clear that it's a multi-gene disease, and it also may be different genes for different people, which looks like the same story for these complex psychiatric illnesses. And there's just preliminary research with brain imaging that's having some interesting results, which seems to indicate that there are multiple brain systems involved, but it's really very preliminary at this point. But researchers think it's really important to find out more what's going on with children. There's some longitudinal studies going on right now to find out what troubled children turn out to be like when they're adults, because some of them who are diagnosed as bipolar as children turn out to be, they're really screwed up adults, but they're not bipolar. They're alcoholics. Alcoholism is very common in this disease. They're depressed, they're anxious, but they don't have the classic signs of cycling. But if you're studying adults alone, you're studying people who've already taken a lot of medication and a lot of life history events that may have interfered with the course of disease. So if you really want to understand how this develops, you need to study children. And the next phase is really to find children who are believed to be vulnerable to the disease, to see if you can find behavioral or possibly even biological indicators of vulnerability. And the idea would be to intervene before the full-blown disease, and you wouldn't have to use so many drugs. And obviously, drugs always work better in combination with therapy, but you do need drugs for diseases like this.
Constance Holden, thank you very much.
Thanks, Rob.
Science news writer Constance Holden on the increasing rates of bipolar disorder diagnoses in children. Read her article in this week's issue. Now with a policy update on the control of nuclear technology, here's Science's deputy editor Barbara Jasny.
In this week's issue of Science magazine, Asia news editor Rich Stone writes about efforts to decontaminate and dismantle the Al-Tuwaitha nuclear center in Iraq. The sprawling center's two nuclear reactors and other facilities for fuel fabrication and plutonium separation were bombed at various times in 1981 and 1991. Starting in 2005, U.S. scientists have been working with the Iraqi government to map the radioactive contamination at Tuwaitha, some of which was scattered by looters. On July 7th, Iraq launched a massive effort to clean up and dismantle the facility. It will cost several million dollars and may take as much as 15 years to complete. By the end of the effort, the Iraqi Science Ministry hopes that part of Tuwaitha will be turned into a science park. In other news, on his way to the G8 summit of national leaders, India's Prime Minister Manmohan Singh told reporters this past week that his administration was moving towards completion of a landmark nuclear agreement with the United States. The agreement would allow India to access nuclear fuel and technology on the world market. Singh has staked his political reputation on reaching this agreement despite opposition within India. Meanwhile, there are ongoing international discussions over the costs and benefits to letting India have access to the international nuclear market without signing the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. Finally, in a symbolic gesture, North Korea destroyed the cooling tower of its nuclear reactor in Yongbyon at the end of June and also provided a long-awaited account of its nuclear activities. However, on Monday, President Bush warned North Korea that it had yet to quell international concerns over its weapons program, including concerns about uranium enrichment.
That was Deputy Editor Barbara Jasny with a policy update from Science and the AAAS Center for Science, Technology, and Congress. If you enjoyed this policy segment and would like to hear more or have other comments about this segment or the podcast itself, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. Finally today, David Grimm, editor of Science's free online daily news site, Science Now, joins us to talk about the latest science stories. Hi, David.
Hey, Rob.
So what stories do you have for us today?
Well, Rob, today we're all about tiny. We're going to talk about tiny amounts of water on the moon, a tiny eyeless worm that can still sense light, and finally, tiny particles for treating cancer.
Well, let's start with tiny amounts of water on the moon. I thought when astronauts brought back parts of the moon, they had done that analysis.
Well, they had, Rob. In fact, the manned missions to the moon in the 1960s and the 1970s did bring back soil from the moon. And one of the big things scientists were interested in at the time is there any evidence for water? And when they analyzed these samples, they didn't see anything.
But now?
But now scientists are taking a second look at those samples. And since the 1960s and 1970s, the techniques for detecting water and other molecules present in very small amounts have vastly improved. So a new team of researchers said, hey, let's try giving these samples another look. So they used these very sensitive techniques, and lo and behold, they found trace amounts of water in volcanic glass beads.
Where do these beads come from?
Well, 3 billion years ago, the moon was a much more active place than it is now, and there was a lot of volcanic activity. So material from deep within the moon was shot out to the surface and resulted in these volcanic beads. And it turns out these beads are hiding trace amounts of water.
How much water are we talking about here?
We're talking about 46 parts per million.
Would that mean that perhaps we could mine the moon for water so that it could support a moon colony or something like that?
Well, that's the implication. I mean, clearly this research isn't indicating that there's liquid water anywhere on the moon, but it does indicate that if there's a lot of this trapped water, even if it's in very small amounts, that someday, maybe in the very, very far future, astronauts may be able to mine this water out of these volcanic glass beads and be able to utilize the water in some way. But the more important implication is that this solves a bit of a riddle about how the moon formed.
How so?
Well, the going theory is that billions of years ago, a Mars-sized object slammed into the Earth and created a bunch of debris that orbited the Earth for a while and eventually coalesced into the moon. But astronomers wondered, if there's so much water on Earth and the moon came from Earth, why is there no water on the moon? And now these researchers are finally showing, hey, there is a bit of water on the moon. So these new findings may answer this cosmic conundrum.
Well, from the conundrum of water on the moon to the conundrum of how an eyeless worm sees light.
Well, Rob, this story is about a tiny worm known as C. elegans. It's actually only about a millimeter long, so you can really only see it under a microscope. And these worms don't have any eyes, and they spend all of their life underground.
Why would they need the ability to sense light then?
Exactly, and scientists had long assumed that they were, for all intents and purposes, blind. But a group of researchers noticed that sometimes when they would shine lights on these worms, the worms would stop in their tracks or even reverse course. So they suspected that even without eyes, the worms had some way of sensing light.
So did they test different types of light?
Yeah, well, first of all, they wanted to confirm if these worms could actually sense light. And if so, they wanted to find out what kind of light do the worms sense. And after a series of experiments, they found that the worms were most sensitive to a type of light known as UVA light, which is the light that gives us suntans.
And sunburns.
And sunburns, exactly.
Which would be important for a worm trying to avoid dangerous exposure by being above ground.
Right. And the researchers speculate that the reason these worms might be sensitive to this light is because if they accidentally make their way above ground, they'll know very quickly that they're in a dangerous place, that these rays are harmful to them, and then go back underground again. And you can see a neat little video of a worm reversing course on the site.
Did the researchers figure out how this sensory system works?
Well, the great thing about C. elegans, and it's actually a very popular worm for laboratory study, is that scientists pretty much know what every cell in the C. elegans body does. And C. elegans have about 302 neurons. So by a process of elimination, the scientists were able to find four neurons that seemed to be responsible for helping the worm sense light. And what was even more interesting was they found that one of these neurons produced tiny electrical currents whenever the worm was exposed to light, much like our eyes produce electrical currents that go to our brain and tell us what we're seeing. And in fact, the worms utilized a couple of molecules that our eyes utilize when we see light. So what's really cool here is not only finding that these quote-unquote blind worms can actually sense light, but this gives us a glimpse, if you will, of how far back in time sight may go. In fact, if we look at this from an evolutionary context, it means that the first creatures may have been sensing light as early as 500 million years ago.
Well, from the cells in worms that allow them to sense light to the cells that go wrong in the body when cancers occur, how are nanoparticles being used to take on cancer?
Well, Rob, the problem with treating cancer is that chemotherapy or any sort of therapy where you're injecting a lot of drugs into the body tends to have some pretty severe side effects.
Because it goes everywhere in the body?
Exactly, because it's hard, especially with drugs, to target specific areas of the body. And so for years, researchers have been trying to figure out if there's a way to make these drugs more specific so that they only hit the cancer and don't affect healthy parts of the body. And this new study concerns a strategy known as nanoparticles. And these are tiny particles, much smaller than a cell, that are made from various compounds. And in this study, they're made from fat-associated molecules. And they can be tethered to specific drugs and made to go specific areas in the body. But it's easier said than done, and there's been a lot of trouble actually getting this to work. But this new study shows some promise, at least in mice, for treating metastasis. And that, as you know, is where cancer cells start out in one place in the body, but invade other parts of the body. And the researchers in this study focused on a receptor called AV-beta-3. And what's important about this receptor is it's found on blood vessels that feed tumors. And the more tumors get fed and the more blood vessels that go to tumors, the more likely a tumor is to metastasize and at least to grow and become more of a problem than it was before.
Does the body use this receptor for any other function?
No, and that's the great thing about it, is it's only present in blood cells that feed tumors, so it's a very specific way of just targeting tumors. And the researchers found that when they took mice that were implanted with human pancreatic tumor cells, so they essentially gave these mice cancer, and then they injected them with these nanoparticles tethered to a chemotherapeutic drug called doxorubicin, that after 11 days, the mice that received the targeted nanoparticle had 82% less metastasis than mice that received nanoparticles that weren't specifically targeted to this AV-beta-3 receptor.
Well, how does this therapy compare to regular chemotherapy treatments?
Well, with regular chemotherapy treatments, say the analogous treatment with doxorubicin, you would have to inject 15 times as much of this drug into the body as you would with nanoparticles. And that's because you have to inject so much because it's going everywhere. But with the nanoparticles, you're injecting a far less amount. And in fact, the researchers found that when they injected what would be normal chemotherapeutic levels of doxorubicin in the mice lost about 18% of their body weight, much like humans might do because of nausea and other factors. But when they were injected with the nanoparticles tethered to doxorubicin, they only lost 0.8% of their body weight. So not only are the researchers showing that the strategy is effective for treating cancer in mice, they're also showing that the side effects are really minimized when you use these targeted nanoparticles.
Well, what are the hurdles then that need to be overcome in order for these type of treatments to be used on people?
Well, there are lingering questions about the toxicity of using any sort of nanoparticle. You know, these things have just come around recently, and so scientists really still haven't fully studied what their health effects are. Is it safe to put these things into the body? So that's going to be one major concern about taking any therapy like this from mice to humans.
Okay. Well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for Science Now?
Well, Rob, we're looking to stories about what makes an avalanche, why biofuels may not be as green as we thought. And finally, we've got a reporter down at a meeting in Miami about coral reefs, and we're going to be posting some stories about what climate change means for the future of coral reefs and also in general for fish in the ocean. So be sure to check out the site.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the free online daily news site of science. You can check out the latest science stories at sciencenow.sciencemag.org. And that wraps up the July 11th, 2008 Science Podcast. The show is a production of Science Magazine and of AAAS, the Science Society. The content is provided by the news and editorial staff of Science, and Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, thanks for joining us.